And good morning, y'all.
All right, if you will, take up your Bibles and turn to chapters 8 and 9. I think one of the dangers that we have is that when we look at the Bible and we look at the history, we have a tendency to not read it as well as we think, and so we kind of hit the high points, right? And we know the stories as they're told to children, okay? And so we know David and Goliath. We know, you know, boy David has to battle Goliath, gets some stones, uses a sling, kills Goliath. And we know Noah and the ark. And we know these high point stories throughout. But a lot of times we miss other things. So we know about Gideon and how he, you know, had the trumpets and the torches and the pitchers, and they scared the army of Midian and they killed themselves. And then we move on to the next story. And we think we've got everything. And there's just so much more that's happened. And we're going to kind of read through this and summarize a little bit, too, of the end of Gideon's story, Gideon's legacy. So we're going to start here at chapter 8, verse 22. So the battle is over. All the enemies have been slain. The people who were upset with Gideon have been pacified. So they come to Gideon at verse 22. Then the men of Israel said to Gideon, "Rule over us, both you and your son, and your grandson also, for you have delivered us from the hand of Midian." But Gideon said to them, "I will not rule over you, nor shall my son rule over you, nor shall the Lord shall rule over you." Then Gideon said to them, "I would like to make a request of you, that each of you would give me the earrings from his plunder." For they had golden earrings because they were Ishmaelites. So they answered, "We will gladly give them." And they spread out a garment, and each man threw into it the earrings from his plunder. Now the weight of the earrings that he requested was 1,700 shekels of gold, besides the crescent ornaments, pendants, and purple robes which were on the kings of Midian, and besides the chains that were around their camels' necks. Then Gideon made it into an ephod, and set it up in his city Ophrah. And all of Israel played the harlot with it there. It became a snare to Gideon and to his house. Thus Midian was subdued before the children of Israel, so that they lifted their heads no more, and the country was quiet for 40 years in the days of Gideon. All right, we're going to continue the story, but let's stop here briefly. So the people come and ask Gideon to be their ruler. Now, what's immediately wrong with this plan?
They should have been asking his gods.
Well, I mean, God was the ruler, and they didn't ask God if it was time for a king. Right, so they didn't ask God. There was no involvement of God in this. This was, "Hey, we think you're great. Why don't you do it?" Okay, and so right, God's not involved in this plan. They haven't consulted him. They haven't been advised by him. And at this point, the children of Israel are in a nation that's been set up with God to be their ruler. Now, some would say, well, you know, it was never God's intention for them to have a king, and that they sinned again later on when Saul's appointed. I don't believe that's true. If you read I think it's Numbers or Deuteronomy, God makes it pretty clear that there will be a king at some point in the future. But they were not yet, and so they were jumping the gun on God's plan. Now, you ever have one of those moments where you are trying to look up a word, and you look it up, and it says, "See such." And so you go over there, and then it says, "See such." And then you go there, and you know, you just keep going around and around. So ephod, I go to look up, you know, I look at my footnotes in my Bible about this whole situation. Gideon makes this ephod with the gold, and my Bible said, hey, check out this passage in 2 Chronicles. So I went there, and this said, check out a passage in 2 Samuel. So I went there, and then that said, check out a passage in Deuteronomy. I'm not kidding you. And none of them ever really explained, like, anything except what an ephod is. But what I wanted to know was, why is it significant here? And it wasn't very helpful. But an ephod was what the priest wore. It's kind of a breastplate, and it contained the Urim and the Thummim, which the priest used as kind of like dice, if you will. But that was God's prescription to the priests to wear this ephod. It had a breastplate on it. It had precious stones on it. And so we can see here that Gideon made this. Now, some of the commentaries, John MacArthur in particular, said that he made this ephod in order to demonstrate or to proclaim that he was the civil authority, that he was the government, and that people could come to him, and that he represented that. So John MacArthur referenced 2 Chronicles, where David is dancing wearing an ephod. And I'm like, that doesn't really seem like the same, like proof of one concept to the other. And that's why I just kind of was chasing around all these passages, and I could not find anybody, any commentator, who could really nail this down for us as to what was happening. So if you've got some other source material that you can share, that'd be fine. But the purpose here that I guess we can look at as I looked at this issue of him making the ephod is that whether or not Gideon was making this to proclaim himself the civil authority, or a religious authority. These seem to be the two options that he was proclaiming. Now, does anybody know where was the religious authority at this time? Anybody? They hadn't built a temple yet, so what did they have?
Priesthood
they had throughout. Before the temple, where was the tabernacle? Okay, the tabernacle is the religious authority before that. Where it was housed. And at this time, the tabernacle was not in Jerusalem, but it was at Shiloh. Now, really interesting that we're already in chapter 9 now of Judges, and we're not hearing anything about the priests or the tabernacle. They're really just a dark age for religious leadership in Israel at this point. And we've discussed that particular truth on several occasions, how the people just didn't know their own history. They didn't know what God had done for them except kind of in legendary form. They didn't really understand the teachings. But so whatever the priests and the Levites were doing at Shiloh wasn't making much of an impact on the people of Israel. So whether or not Gideon made this ephod, set it up there as a symbol to show that he was civil authority, or whether he was even going so far as to represent that he was a religious authority and that people should come to him for guidance and that he could do what the priests were supposed to do, is unclear. Either way, what is clear is that this was done outside of God's authority, outside of God's plans. So whichever one of these two was happening. Now, I don't think Gideon, I think it's very clear that Gideon was not attempting necessarily to lead the people far astray, to lead them into idolatry, but he was falling victim to what? To his own pride, right? To his own, hey, look, I did this great thing for all of you. I'll continue to do good things for you. I like being in charge. I like being liked by the people. So Gideon shows us that he still has some moral moorings because he turned down being king. He's still showing that he understands that God is truly the one who should be the ruler of the people, but he's also seeming to enjoy the opportunity to be in charge, to be a bigwig, to be important. So, and we're going to come to this point. We're building up to this. So you'll have to kind of keep this train of thought. Okay, don't lose what we're talking about. We're going to pick up the story here at verse 29. Then Jerubbaal, the son of Joash, went and dwelt in his own house. Jerubbaal is just another name for Gideon. Gideon had 70 sons who were his own offspring, for he had many wives. And his concubine, who was in Shechem, also bore him a son, whose name he called Abimelech. Now, Gideon, the son of Joash, died at a good old age and was buried in the tomb of Joash, his father, in Ophrah of the Abarizites. Now, anybody know what the name Abimelech means? Anybody's Bible tell you?
King of God or something like that.
Means my father is king.
King, yeah.
Strange name to name your son when you just turned down being the king, right? So, I mean, perhaps Gideon didn't even name him. Perhaps his mother named him, since it was a concubine that was in another town where he didn't live. He fathered this son, and then she named him, my father is king, Abimelech. Let's keep going. So it was, as soon as Gideon was dead, that the children of Israel again played the harlot with the Baals, and made Baal-Berith their king. Thus the children of Israel did not remember the Lord their God, who had delivered them from the hands of all their enemies on every side, nor did they show kindness to the house of Jerubbaal, Gideon, in accordance with the good he had done for Israel. Wow. They didn't wait very long, right? Just right back to it. So we see this ephod causes them to stumble in the first place, and they played the harlot to it. And then as soon as Gideon was gone, then there was nothing holding them back from returning to their idolatry. So, it gets worse now. And this is a part of the story that we often kind of skip over. So, chapter 9. Then Abimelech, the son of Jerubbaal, went to Shechem, to his mother's brothers, and spoke with them, with all the family, and the house of his mother's father, saying, please speak in the hearing of the men of Shechem, which is better for you, that all 70 of the sons of Jerubbaal reign over you, or that one reign over you. Remember, I am your own flesh and bone. And his mother's brothers spoke all these words concerning him in the hearing of the men of Shechem, and their heart was inclined to follow Abimelech, for they said, he is our brother. So they gave him 70 shekels of silver from the temple of Baal-Berith, which is in Abimelech, with which Abimelech hired worthless and reckless men, and they followed him. Then he went to his father's house at Ophrah and killed his brothers, the 70 sons of Jerubbaal, on one stone. But Jotham, the youngest son of Jerubbaal, was left because he had hid himself. And all the men of Shechem gathered together, all of Beth Millo, and they went and made Abimelech king beside the terebinth pillar tree at the pillar which was in Shechem. So things have got real ugly real fast. Okay, so Abimelech has killed Gideon's 70 legitimate sons and asked for his mother's family to help him take over all of this power. And now he's the king of this area of Israel. And so what's gone on now? This wasn't what Gideon wanted. Gideon didn't want a kingship for himself. He didn't want it for his sons. And yet now one of his sons has it. Gideon's legacy is really in bad shape, right? It's really tattered. And we learn a few important lessons here. And I guess that we're still getting to my main point, so you have to stick with me as we build this case. But chapter 9, there's this whole confrontation that comes up here where Jotham confronts the people of Shechem, prophesies against them that they'll be destroyed by fire because of Abimelech, and that Abimelech will be destroyed by the fire of Shechem. He tells an interesting little parable about the trees. And then God sends in God sends an evil spirit into, or evil thoughts, not evil thoughts, but it's, he sends a discontent spirit between the people of Shechem and Abimelech, and so they start attacking each other. And it's a long, drawn-out affair. I encourage you to read it all, but we're just going to summarize. So then go ahead to verse 50 of chapter 9. Then Abimelech went to Thebes, and he encamped against Thebes and took it. But there was a strong tower in the city, and all the men and women, all the people of the city fled there and shut themselves in. Then they went up to the top of the tower. So Abimelech came as far as the tower and fought against it. And he drew near to the door of the tower to burn it with fire. But a certain woman dropped a millstone on Abimelech's head and crushed his skull. And he called quickly to the young man, his armor-bearer, and said, "Draw your sword and kill me, lest men say a woman killed me." So his young man thrust him through, and he died. And when the men of Israel saw that Abimelech was dead, they departed, every man to his own place. And that's the end of Abimelech. And I guess I should have mentioned that he had there was a previous tower that he attacked too, and he burned that one. So he burned the men of Shechem in a tower. And then he went to burn another tower, and he got a stone dropped on his head. And so the prophecy of Jotham was fulfilled, that they ended up, the two sides ended up killing each other. So we see a few lessons. First off, one, you don't prosper if you don't live in obedience to God's word. You don't outgrow the need for God's strength and power, and that you can win the whole world but still lose your own family. And that's what I want to talk a little bit about, is this legacy. Gideon had won this great victory, but his legacy was in tatters. His family was in tatters. It didn't go well. Things fell apart. He has 70 children by multiple wives, which is always a recipe for disaster, right? Always a recipe for disaster. But why did this happen? And I want to turn our attention to the idea that Gideon won and the children of Israel won the wrong victory. What was the status? One of these markers is really good and one of them's not, so I'm always trying to find the good one. The other two kind of so. Okay, so when we first find Gideon, what's the situation? Israel is being terrorized by the Midianites, right? Midian's coming in, taking their crops, killing people, terrorizing the countryside, and the children of Israel cry out to God, and they say, "Help us, deliver us," right? And so God delivers them, and so they have a victory over Midian. But the question is, why were they in servitude to Midian in the first place?
They didn't follow God.
How was that demonstrated? What was their... What was the most obvious...
Other rivals.
Right. Idolatry. Okay? And so, they've got this problem and this problem. And they ask for victory, and what does God do for them? What does God... When he comes to deliver them, what does he say? "I'm going to deliver you with 300 people. To do what?
Demonstrate my authority.
To demonstrate God's authority, right? That's the lesson of the 300. What's the lesson of the 300? Summarize it. How many does God need?
One.
None.
I call him as one.
Okay. All right. And so what I'm getting at is that God gave the people the victory that they asked for over Midian, And he did it, so it was his victory, in order to demonstrate to them that the victory they needed was not a victory over Midian. He was giving them a victory over not just idolatry as one thing, but over sin as the main thing. Okay? God's victory is a victory over the real cause of our problems, right? And the children of Israel, they, in the end, didn't receive that victory. They got this victory, the victory over Midian, but they didn't receive the victory that God actually was trying to give them, which was over their sinfulness, was over their idolatry. He gave them a victory that they asked for to prove himself, but the people, they didn't follow. They didn't get it. They didn't get the victory that they really needed, which was what? What do we all need? What is the ultimate victory that we all need?
To God.
Right, and what's that?
Over our pride.
Over our sin, right? How do we get a victory over sin?
Salvation.
Which is a what?
Recovery.
I know I'm asking you to read my mind, yeah. So I mean, I'm not accusing anybody of being wrong.
Right.
What's that?
Submission to God's direction.
Submission to God's direction.
Power of the Holy Spirit.
Power, which does what?
Convicts us, guides us.
I don't care. You're not gonna. Nobody's gonna read my mind this morning, apparently. We need new life, new hearts. We need regeneration. Okay, we need to be born again. Okay. This is why the people just went right back to it immediately. I mean, they were already falling just when Gideon said, "No, I won't be your king, but here, come to me for your help." And they're like, "Okay, we're not going to go to God who gave us this victory. We're not going to get changed. We're not going to be different people. We're not going to undo the very thing that got us into this mess in the first place. All we wanted was a victory over the people who are stealing our food. We just want our stuff. We just want to live the way we want to. So God, just come in, we'll rub the lamp, get the genie out, get rid of these bad people, and let me go back to doing what I was doing before. Now that they're gone, I can do what I want and not worry about it." And they're forgetting all the lessons that God's teaching, that every time they fall away, he can raise up new people to interfere and to cause them to need him again. But ultimately, they won the wrong victory. They didn't get the victory that God wanted to give them, which was new hearts, new lives, new ways of thinking. And so, it reminded me of the woman at the well. Right? What did she want?
Water that she wouldn't have to go back and get more water.
But not at first. Okay. Right? What was she there at the well for?
Water.
She wanted water. Right? And Jesus said, "If you knew who I was, you would ask me for living water. Everybody who drinks this water is going to be thirsty again. But anybody who drinks the water that I give him will never thirst again." Right? That's what God is offering these people. And they didn't get it. They didn't get it. And so it was right back to their sinfulness. It was not having new life, new hearts, regeneration. It was not being born again. And they trusted their own hearts. Okay, what does the Bible tell us about that? We're going to look up a few verses here. Anne probably has them memorized.
Deceitfully wicked.
Jeremiah 17:9 and Proverbs 28:26. And some of you also want to look up, we're going to do a couple of other important verses here and tie this up. 1 Corinthians 10:12 and 1 Peter 5:8-9. Alright, does anybody have Jeremiah 17:9? Read it nice and loud. Anne?
The heart is deceitful of all, and desperately wicked, who can know it?
That's right, the heart is deceitful above all things and desperately wicked, who can know it? Okay, Proverbs 28:26.
Whoever trusts in his own mind is a fool, but he who walks in wisdom will be delivered.
Yeah, whoever trusts in his own mind. This is what Gideon did, right? Got to this moment all the time before, right? Hey, God, what do I do next? What do I do next? Give me a sign. Give me a sign. Are you sure? Are you sure? And he gets to this one. It's like, hey, I'm going to be in charge now. Everybody come to me. Okay? The heart's desperately wicked. It's deceitful. You trust your own heart. How many times do we hear that still in this world? What does your heart tell you you should do? What does your heart tell you you should do? Don't trust your own heart. And when are Christians and Gideon most vulnerable to the deceptiveness of their own hearts?
After a victory?
After a victory. Okay, so now we're going to look at these two verses. Anybody look up 1 Corinthians 10:12 yet?
Therefore, let anyone who thinks that he stands take heed lest he fall.
Lest anyone who thinks he stands take heed lest he falls. How about this one? 1 Peter 5:8-9.
Be sober-minded, be watchful. Your adversary, the devil, prowls around like a roaring lion, seeking someone to devour. Resist him. Firm in your faith, knowing that the same kinds of suffering are being experienced by your brotherhood throughout the world.
What does the winning team do? And that's a bit of a joke, so I'm looking for a lighthearted answer here. But after a team wins the Super Bowl, what's the joke? What do they do next?
Go to Miami.
Go to Disney World, right? Or go to Disneyland. Remember the TV commercials? What are you going to do next? My kids are too young for those commercials. But hey, so-and-so, what are you? You just won the Super Bowl. What are you going to do next? I'm going to Disney World, you know? I wonder how much I got paid for saying that, right? But what do we do after a victory?
Celebrate.
We celebrate. We let our guard down. And the next thing you know, we fail again. Now, Pastor, I'll put you on the spot for a second. Do you ever feel like a great victory after preaching a sermon on a Sunday?
Never.
You struggle all week, right? You labor all week. You come up, you give this sermon. Sometimes they go really well. And then is the rest of your day perfect? No sin, never anger, no fights with the wife. Everything goes great the rest of the day, right?
Well, she stays upstairs, I go downstairs, uh-huh. So we're good there. No.
Right. How many of you know that some of the worst failures of sin that you have come after the mountaintop experience? Mm-hmm. You get back from camp or a rally or a wedding or some other great moment where you've seen God have a victory, and yet sin's lurking at the door. And for those football teams and those baseball teams that win their great victories, what's the curse of winning? Right? The next year they almost never win again. Right? Especially in football. I mean, it's just they get fat and lazy and sloppy and too many dinners and too many trips to the golf course. Right? Why? So what is it? What is the underlying principle here about sin when it comes to our victories? Why is it? We rest. Sin never rests. Right? It's always lurking. It's always prowling, like we read there. Okay? It's always, take heed lest you fall. Because why? Why?
Because you will fall.
Because your adversary, the devil, is like a roaring lion, right? And so we see that Gideon fell into this trap. He had this victory, okay? But then he didn't continue on the straight path. And next thing you know, he's married all these women. He's got all these kids. He's still sleeping with a servant, a concubine, and having another one. And his whole legacy is in tatters now. Everything is torn up. He himself missed ultimately what the victory was. Victory was supposed to be him being changed by God, making him a new person, being different than he was before, being different than Israel was before. And Israel especially missed out on this victory. And so, you know, I don't like to be too hard on Gideon, and I don't think the scriptures are that hard on Gideon, because he's even in the hall of faith in the book of Hebrews. And we see that after his setting up his judging rule over the people, that they did have peace for 40 years, that God did bless them, okay, and kept them from trouble. But it says right away, from the day the ephod was set up, that the children of Israel played the harlot to it, because they weren't following God the way they were supposed to. They were seeking out Gideon's counsel or his religious leadership. I don't know which it is, but it was the beginning of Gideon's slide, and it was for the people of Israel just simply a return back to what they wanted in the first place was. They just wanted God to get rid of their enemies so they could keep behaving however they wanted. And when Gideon left this earth, then the final check was gone, and they immediately went back to serving the Baals. They hadn't been changed at all. So what are your thoughts? I have one, I'll add one more, and that is that we can also look at this and realize whether Gideon was religious or civil in his leadership, or both, that our earthly leaders are always going to disappoint us. Okay, whether they're our government officials or our church officials, even our pastor, they're not perfect people. And they're always going to slip, they're always going to fall, there's always going to be those failures. And when we, like Israel, look to Gideon and then to Abimelech to just do their thing so I can have what I want, then it ends in disaster. Who is supposed to be our infallible head?
God.
Jesus Christ, right? And if we look to a man or a woman to be our infallible leader in politics or in the church, we're going to have failures. We're going to have a lot of failures. And, you know, I think, especially at church, people can get so down. And I'm not saying that about us and about Dave or anything, but, you know, you get disappointed by the pastor on a Sunday because he says something wrong, or, you know, there was some decision made that you don't like, and people get angry and they walk away. Well, you know, I can't believe he said that. I can't believe he did that. I can't believe the elders were that way. And it's not... So we leave because, well, I'm not going to stand for that. But yet, our leadership, our true leader is Christ. And we have to give grace to the ones who he puts ahead of us, whether it's the civil authorities or our church authorities. Other thoughts? That was one of mine.
Yeah. I did a little bit of research on ephod myself.
Okay, good.
And one of the commentaries I read was that the ephod that was talked about here, there's two schools of thought. The one is the garment, mm-hmm, that you talked about, and the other is that there was a small idol that they would put a garment on when it wasn't worn, and that over a period of time, it got called the ephod, as the idol itself being, mm-hmm, called ephod, just because of the connection between the two. Mm-hmm. And the thought was that what he actually made was a small idol that was basically kind of portable, in that it could be picked up and moved. And that's what I had studied from. I don't remember exactly, you know, all the details of that. But.
And somehow it denoted, as he took it with him, that he was the authority. You know, come and see me, I'm the authority.
Yeah.
It's also really interesting, for those of you who, you know, read your Bibles, what is this a direct kind of copy of that happened earlier? He said, set out this blanket and throw your earrings in it. And then out from that comes this ephod. Where did this happen before?
In the wilderness, where they did the calf.
Right, they came to Aaron, right? And Aaron said, take off your gold earrings. And then what did he say happened when Moses confronted him? I threw him in a fire and out came this gold calf. Right? So it's very, and what did Aaron proclaim? You see this synchronism that happens, right? He said, he made this calf, and then he said, now is a day of festival to the Lord, right? Here's your God that brought you out of Egypt, but we're also going to have a festival to God. And you see just the confusion and the lostness of the people, trying to honor God, but also trying to do it their own way, right? Dad?
Two things. We studied the ephod question a bit as well, and it appeared